Tonight on Arena, who wrote Citizen Kane? Paul Whittington investigates. And for the season that's in it, the Irish Baroque Orchestra bring us Handel's Messiah. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. It's the stuff of Hollywood legend, the piece of cinema historians and directors go back to again and again, citing its class, its vision and its epic stature as profoundly influential. Citizen Kane is a touchstone of American movie making, a remarkable artistic achievement from Orson Welles, who took Hollywood, the Hollywood of 1940, by storm. He was just 25 years of age. But Mank, a new film from David Fincher, focuses on Herman Mankiewicz, the carousing Hollywood screenwriter who, along with Welles and to a degree, is the subject of hot debate and considerable controversy, composed the script of Citizen Kane. Paul Whittington, I'm delighted, is actually with me in studio to get stuck into this.
Yeah.
Before we get into the debate, Paul.
Yes.
Citizen Kane itself, I don't think you can underestimate its influence, but put it in the context of the Hollywood in which it was made. What kind of place was that Hollywood?
The Hollywood in which it was made, it was a boom town. Since the arrival of sound in particular, Hollywood had grown bigger and bigger. There was a group of studios that dominated it, and films were made to formula in a way. Stars were under contract, directors too. The producers and the studio owners ruled, and writers were at the bottom of the rung. A lot of these, you know, people like F. Scott Fitzgerald, all these, you know, incredible talents had been drawn to Hollywood by the lure of filthy lucre. And they found themselves in very unhappy positions, because the way they would do it was, you do the dialogue, I'll do the... So nobody actually created anything on their own, and they all wished they'd tried to be novelists instead and had drink problems.
It was writing by committee.
Yes, it was writing by committee. It was everything by committee. And then Welles came along, and Welles, of course, had caused a huge sensation as a young man in theatre in New York. And RKO gave him this contract, and it was an unprecedented contract in which he would write, direct, act in, produce two pictures for them, and he would have the right to the final cut. This was unheard of. So before he ever arrived in Hollywood, everybody hated him, because he was young, he was talented, and he'd been given his way.
It would have been the producers, the money men, who would have had the final say up to this point.
And the studio bosses, absolutely. Yeah.
They were the people who held the power. So
everybody worked for them. Yeah.
So where into that scenario then does Herman Mankiewicz fit?
Herman Mankiewicz was, he's a very interesting character. He was part of the Algonquin set. He was a newspaper man to begin with, and he was part of that very witty sort of bitching club that revolved around the Algonquin Hotel in the 1920s. Dorothy Parker, all those people. And he was given a contract in the early 30s to go to Hollywood. He looked down on pictures, as a lot of you know, intellectual types did, and thought, I'll be here for 2 years. He was there for the rest of his life. And he, by the time Welles came along, he was very unhappy. And in fact, Welles threw him a lifeline.
Ah.
Because Welles asked him to collaborate first on this picture. Welles wanted to do a picture of an adaptation of Heart of Darkness, and he worked all that up, but then he couldn't do it. And then they sat down together and tried to think up a story about a great American who's flawed morally. And they thought about Dillinger, the gangster, and then it was Mankiewicz who suggested William Randolph Hearst, whom he knew.
All right, I tell you what, let's just take a clip from the David Fincher film. We'll come back to David Fincher's particular angle on the script in a minute, because I think the meeting of Mankiewicz, played by Gary Oldman, a lot of scenery eaten during the making of this film.
Yeah, and he's good in it, though.
He is, yeah. Mm. And Charles Dance playing William Randolph Hearst. So here's the moment when the screenwriter meets the newspaper mogul.
Mankiewicz. Herman Mankiewicz, New York playwright and drama critic.
Turned humble screenwriter, Mr. Hearst.
Why? No need to be humble, Mr. Mankiewicz. Picture's the talk of the future. They're gonna need people who honor words, give them voice. There's a golden age coming when all the world will be a stage. And you, perhaps, they're Shakespeare.
Oh, I wouldn't have thought you'd be that keenly interested in the honoring of words.
What's so funny?
I'm just surprised that a vaunted muckraker like yourself sees Hollywood's future as such a shiny penny.
Back to what?
Times are changing, Mr. Mankiewicz. And I'm not just referring to this depression.
All that bother.
Now, when all this is over, picture makers are going to have to service this new entertainment. I intend to make pictures with the help of real literary minds.
I'd support that.
Instead, what do most studios give us? Gangster flicks. Zanies.
Too true.
Now, how many gangsters do Americans meet in a lifetime? How many families are like the Marx Brothers?
You mean besides my own?
Ha! Very good.
There we go. Charles Dance and Gary Oldman in a scene there from Mank, which is the David Fincher retelling of the story.
Absolutely.
Of the writing of Citizen Kane. And we won't get into the performances because we're going to review the film itself on Thursday night, Paul. But I do want to talk about the backstory here and the whole debate around the writing of Citizen Kane.
Yeah, and David Fincher's father wrote the screenplay. Jack, he was a journalist and he wrote in the 90s. And I think that it nearly got made in the 90s and then he died. And Fincher kept it in his back pocket.
And Fincher, I suppose, Fincher wouldn't have had the kind of clout that he has now.
No, exactly. To make a black and white film, which his father insisted it must be. And it is a beautiful looking film. Two and a bit hours as well. But basically, Jack Fincher based his premise upon an article by Pauline Kael called Raising Cain.
This was the big New York film
50,000 words. She's a big New Yorker film writer. She was very acerbic, very funny. She had taken down some big beasts in the past, you know, like David Lean. She kind of sent him into huffy retirement in the late 60s after she reviewed Ryan's Daughter. And she wrote this thing anyway. She hated the auteur theory of Andrew Farris and Truffaut, now that she didn't like the idea.
Did she just not like auteur, the idea of auteur in general, or did she particularly not like it in the case of Orson Welles?
Well, Orson Welles was the kind of patron saint of auteurs. She liked classic Hollywood era films where there was this great melange of talents in the middle of it, and she didn't like the idea that the director was everything, and she thought it was misleading, and she was right in a way. But Welles was the big beast, and she decided to take him down. She wrote this essay. She said that Mankiewicz had written this in isolation in a cabin when he was recovering from a car accident. Part of that's true, and that Welles had nothing to do with it, but that afterwards he claimed credit for it, and that Mankiewicz had to fight for a screenplay credit because it won an Oscar. The only Oscar that Orson Welles or Kane ever won was for the screenplay.
But the screenwriter versus the director, that's an old battle, isn't it?
It's an old battle, but here specifically it's writer versus writer as well, because Peter Bogdanovich, who was a Welles friend and collaborator, he immediately rebuffed Kael's thing, and he questioned her scholarship. He also wondered why she hadn't bothered to speak to Orson Welles, who was alive at the time and apparently livid about this idea.
He was livid at the idea that
Mankiewicz had written it on his own. Absolutely, absolutely. He was raging. But this theory stuck with some people, and this debate has raged ever since. And apparently, David Fincher said he had to water down the screenplay because it was very overtly anti-Welles, as it is now. Welles he's played by Tom Burke. He's just an comes in now and again to be annoying. But Mank, the film, David Fincher film, is totally convinced that Mankiewicz wrote the screenplay on his own.
Yeah, and despite the shortened version of the name, Mank was a term of endearment.
It sounds like it isn't, but it is.
So we're in no doubt in Fincher's film as to who wrote the script, because let's listen to this. Is a scene quite early on. You say he's had a car accident. He's kind of holed up and he's been kept away from the drink,
from the alcohol,
as much as they can. And here he is dictating a little piece for the potential film Citizen Kane.
Once a castle on a hill, now in memory of what once was. Alone in his unfinished, already decaying pleasure palace, aloof, seldom visited, never photographed, we see an old man in a robe, smoking a pipe, sitting alone by his pool of discarded pages scattered at his feet. Narrator: an emperor of newsprint continued to direct his failing empire, vainly attempting to sway as he once did the destinies of a nation which had long since ceased to listen to him. Had ceased to trust him. We see through trees as an aide pushes this old man in a wheelchair across neatly groomed lawns.
Narrator, there, last month, as it must to all men, death came to.
So there you go. Oh. There you go. Open the right fader, Sean. Gary Oldman as...
Killing a fly.
He kills a fly just at the very end of it there. But that's from the David Fincher film Mank about the whole theory around the writing of Citizen Kane, which is what Paul Whittington is speaking to us about this evening. I mean, there's no doubt it almost sounds like Citizen Kane in places, that script, doesn't it?
It is. It's lifted from it. Mm. And obviously, Gary Oldman does it very well. You have this painted picture of the beginning, that wonderful tracking shot into the mansion, the Kane mansion, and so on. And it's very compelling and very persuasive. And as I say, Wells in it is just a kind of an annoying, juvenile, actor who has a huge ego, which he did.
What kind of a career had Mankiewicz established for himself at this point? We heard Charles Dance as Hearst pointing out, the New York drama critic and playwright.
Yeah.
Was that his background? Was it the high intellectual background that we had, or what had he done in terms of film?
Yeah, he'd done essays. He was a humorist. He was a great colour writer in newspapers. And when he got to Hollywood, he was one of about seven or eight people who worked on Wizard of Oz. He'd had three or four films, but he found the process of the collaborative process very frustrating. He wanted a big stage, and as I say, Wells gave it to him. There is no doubt he had the car crash. He wasn't driving, by the way, it wasn't his fault, and he was supposed to be drying out, although he had a genius for locating alcohol wherever he was. And he set to, and John Houseman, actually, Wells' collaborator on the Mercury Theatre, was his babysitter. He used to look in and see who was behaving himself, and he had someone to dictate to. He did write a screenplay, there's no doubt about that. But what's in doubt is what happened next.
Yeah, what was Wells' role in that? But just sticking with Mankiewicz for the moment, certainly in parts of this film, we get he certainly isn't a good husband. I think that's fair to say. His wife is constantly referred to as, is she Sandra or Sarah? Poor Sarah or poor?
Poor Sarah
all the time.
Yes.
By everybody, which is hugely patronising, obviously. So we get that aspect of his character. But we get this sense as well that he's been very kindly to, remember, we're in wartime Europe.
Yeah.
And that he has rescued and paid for people to get over. Is that true? Is that a basis in fact?
I looked into that. There's not a great deal. I think he's rather sentimentalized in this. There's not a great deal of evidence to suggest that he rescued an entire
village, as they say here,
of Jewish people. Although he was well disposed, but he was of European Jewish extraction, one generation himself. So he was well disposed towards all that. But he had this rather waspish background, and he could find no platform. And then with this, he got the platform. But to suppose, as Cale did, that Orson Welles, for the only time in his career, was presented with a screenplay, sat back and did nothing with it and said, this is good, let's go for this, it just seems ridiculous. Because throughout his career, he took the blue pencil to Joseph Conrad. I don't know if you've ever seen Chimes at Midnight. He rewrote the history plays, basically Shakespeare's plays. He always did that with everything. He was a rewriter rather than a writer, but he always had ideas and notes. So the idea that he didn't in this film is ridiculous. And also, Cale's theory presupposes that the screenplay was the film, whereas, of course, there's beautiful writing, as we heard in the film, but the remarkable thing about the film was its look, and that's Wells and Greg Toland. And Wells always said that his great advantage was that he didn't know anything about cinema. He watched Stagecoach again and again, the John Ford film, to learn how to do it, but he brought all these ideas, this German expressionist ideas that he'd used in theatre to the film. So the look of the film is probably more important than anything. So that's another aspect of it.
Well, let's have a listen to his acting as well in the midst of Citizen Kane. Wells is acting, that is, playing Charles Foster Kane, is very thinly disguised William Randolph Hearst.
Yeah.
And here he is talking to his banker. Needless to say, he's in a little bit of trouble. But when you have money like his, a little bit of trouble is not really a problem. Yeah. Thatcher the banker, Charles Clouris it is who's playing it, isn't it? Here we go.
The trouble is you don't realise you're talking to two people. As Charles Foster Kane, who owns 82,364 shares of Public Transit Preferred, you see, I do have a general idea of my holdings. I sympathize with you. Charles Foster Kane is a scoundrel. His paper should be run out of town. A committee should be formed to boycott him. You may, if you can form such a committee, put me down for a contribution of $1,000.
My time's
on the other hand, I am the publisher of the Enquirer. As such, it's my duty, and I'll let you in on a little secret. It's also my pleasure to see to it that decent, hard-working people in this community aren't robbed blind by a pack of money-mad pirates just because they haven't anybody to look after their interests. I'll let you in on another little secret, Mr. Thatcher. I think I'm the man to do it, you see. I have money and property. If I don't look after the interests of the underprivileged, maybe somebody else will. Maybe somebody without any money or property.
Yes, yes,
and that
yes.
Would
money
be too
and property.
Bad.
Well, I happened to see your financial statement today, Charles.
Oh, did you?
Now, tell me honestly, my boy, don't you think it's rather unwise to continue this philanthropic enterprise, this Enquirer that's costing you $1 million a year?
You're right, Mr. Thatcher. I did lose $1 million last year. I expect to lose $1 million this year. I expect to lose $1 million next year. You know, Mr. Thatcher, at the rate of $1 million a year, I'll have to close this place in 60 years.
That is a good joke.
There he is.
Whoever wrote it, whether it was Wells or whether it was Mankiewicz. That was from the actual Citizen Kane, Orson Welles as Charles Foster Kane and George Calouris as Thatcher the banker, Paul Whittington. Just to wrap up on it then, Paul, from what you're saying, I get the impression you feel, yes, Mankiewicz may have written a big bundle of the script.
Oh, he did, yeah.
But Welles took the script and did what he did with every script. He made it into a film, which is different from a script.
Why would this be the only film in which he didn't do that? Cale made much of the fact that Welles made it he didn't want to give Mankiewicz a writing credit. But the reason for that was not just his ego, it was because of his contract. He was worried that he would be in breach. If he wasn't the brilliant wonder kid who did everything, he would be in breach of his contract with RKO. So I just don't think the argument is very compelling. But the film is very good.
And the consequences in terms of subsequent outcomes for both Welles and Mankiewicz?
Mankiewicz, it kind of did no harm to his reputation. He did a couple of good films thereafter, Pride of the Yankees, things like that, and he was doing fine until his gambling and drinking overtook him and he died. I think he was in his 50s when he died. Welles became a pariah in Hollywood, largely because of William Randolph Hearst, who was extremely vindictive. His second film was butchered by RKO when he was in Mexico, and thereafter he found it practically impossible to get films financed, and he became a kind of peripatetic actor around Europe, raising money himself to make his own films, but he still managed to make them.
He certainly did. Oh, it's a fascinating story, isn't it? And I suppose the David Fincher film just adds to the many versions of that story. Paul Whittington speaking to us there about who wrote Citizen Kane, and Mank, the David Fincher telling of that tale, is on Netflix, starts this weekend on Netflix. We will be reviewing it on Thursday night's programme. Romy, otherwise known as Romy Madley Croft of the XX, with her new solo single, Lifetime. Since the beginning of the month, the National Concert Hall has been running a series of live-streamed classical music performances in collaboration with some of our finest artists and ensembles. This Thursday, December the 3rd, the series continues with a perennial favourite, Handel's Messiah, performed by the Irish Baroque Orchestra and singers from Chamber Choir Ireland. Handel's Messiah, of course, received its first performance here in Ireland, or here in Dublin, in fact, almost three centuries ago. Its appeal, it would seem, has never waned. And joining me tonight are Peter Whelan, artistic director and conductor of the Irish Baroque Orchestra, along with soprano Sarah Power, who is one of the featured singers for this upcoming performance. Handel's Messiah, Peter, it really is one of those pieces. You can be sure when it's been played, you'll have a full house, this year being different, obviously, in that respect. But It's so popular. What is it that has lasted almost 300 years? What is it about a piece of oratorio that makes it so special, do you think?
Oh, it's a very good question, but I know at least in Ireland, we have such an ownership of the piece. Of course, like you said, the very first performance in 1742 was ours. And it was a time, you know, when Handel was having a terrible time in London. It was all going wrong for him with his health, with finances, everything else. And coming to Dublin changed everything for him. So we also kind of hold ourselves responsible for turning the tide of a great composer. But apart from that, it's just full of belters, of choruses, and it's just he just was. Of course, he's a great composer, but he's just onto a really good thing with this piece. And there are just so many great choruses, so many catchy tunes. It's a great, you know, flow to the piece. I think all of that, and as well as that, just all of the, you know, the anecdotes, the stories behind it too. It's a brilliant work on every level.
And I guess what we're talking about here, it's basically the Christian story, from prophecy through birth of Jesus through passion and death and resurrection.
That's right. And the amazing thing about the first Dublin performance was that it was in a secular hall in Fishamble Street, so not in the church. So that in itself was quite controversial at the time. And you have people like Jonathan Swift, who's very much against the idea, although he wasn't in his best mind at the time. He was already kind of in his decline. But that's what caused part of the scandal and the interest around it in the first place. You have one singer, Susanna Kibber, traveling over from London. She was singing the central alto parts. He Was Despised, and she was escaping from a tabloid sex scandal in London, and all over the paper, like images of her and having an affair with somebody else. She came to Dublin. She thought she'd escape all of that salacious gossip, and of course everybody here knew about it completely. It was in the newspaper too, and that's one of the main draws to the theatre, to see this woman of ill repute singing a religious piece. And Handel, of course, is an absolute genius and a businessman. He knew who he's working with.
And as you said,
that
idea, an oratorio, obviously, ora coming from the Latin word to pray, that this sacred music and sacred text in a secular hall with a so-called person of ill repute singing one of the parts. was it really playing into all of that? Because there were too many tickets sold apart from anything else.
Yeah, no, he was definitely. That's definitely why most people were there, and all the stories about leaving the hoops and the swords outside, and the one-way system in Fishamble Street, like put into place. It was to see this. People knew that this woman had a story to tell, and how it would fit in with this religious text. And Handel, in a genius way, he's appealing to the public to forgive her. Using biblical texts, and it could have gone any number of ways. Like, she wasn't famous as a singer; she's famous as an actress. So something about the pathos of the way she delivered that it really spoke to people. And one of the many anecdotes attached to Messiah was that she was forgiven by a preacher who shouted out as she sang it, a woman, for this thy sins be forgiven thee. So it's all part of the drama of the evening. So obviously he pulled it off, Handel. Part of the folklore.
Extraordinary stuff indeed. As I say, many of the stories possibly apocryphal, but nevertheless they're great stories. Sarah, now thankfully you're playing the soprano part, so we don't have to ask you anything about what your motivation for singing He Was Despised. But what really struck me in some of the soprano pieces, it's the speed at which you'd be singing, which is multiplied, I suppose we could say, because of the nature of the Irish Baroque Orchestra and this not pared back performance, but probably something closer to the original forces that Handel had in mind, Sarah.
Yes, certainly Rejoice Greatly is sort of well known as being a piece that moves at a ferocious speed and has a lot of runs and decorations and ornaments. Handel writes such singable music that, you know, it's not easy. Maybe suits the voice,
I enjoy it. And have you sung the soprano role in this before?
Yes, I have quite a number of times. I think the first time I sang it was in 2009 with the Bray Choral Society. That's where I'm from. And then I've sort of sung it all over the place, like places like the Royal Albert Hall, even Tenerife on one occasion. But I've never sung it at the National Concert Hall before.
Yeah.
So it'd be lovely to sing
there.
Yeah,
certainly excitement about that. Well, let's have a listen. You mentioned the soprano air Rejoice Greatly, and we have a Trinidadian soprano here, Janine Dibik. This was recorded at the BBC Proms in 2017. The speed of this leaves me almost breathless. So there we had Janine Dibik at the BBC Proms 2017 singing Rejoice Greatly from Handel's Messiah. And Sarah Power, the soprano who will be singing that part in the National Concert Hall, is with us this evening, as is Peter Whelan of the Irish Baroque Orchestra. That is quite some speed that they take it at in that particular performance. But the nature of the Irish Baroque Orchestra and the instruments that you're playing, Peter, will certainly facilitate a speedier delivery.
That's right. So we like to play on a historically informed instrument. So we try to use copies or actually original instruments from the time of the pieces we're playing. Very often you have modern instruments, modern violins, for instance, that have to be, you know, set backwards. We take off the chin rests. They can be set up differently, and the bow is a kind of a different shape, and it's lighter on its feet than a modern bow, which means that we can kind of move things along more briskly a lot of the time, especially for you know an aria like that one. But it just makes the whole thing skip along a little bit more easily, and expresses the music in a different way. Just, you know, little rhetorical details that speak more clearly when you're using these old instruments.
And does the presence of those, Peter refers to the different bow and the strings would be slightly different, the wood, you mightn't have metal strings necessarily in this case, Sarah. Does the agility of the instrument, does that make it easier for the singer, do you think, to actually singing it at speed? Sometimes these things, you think slowing it down might be useful, possibly for learning it, but maybe singing it at speed brings its own energy, does it?
Well, yes, the great thing about... Oh, sorry.
Go ahead, Sarah.
It brings a nice colour to the singing, I think. And, I mean, some of these long phrases, you want to keep moving. You know, you want to have lots of energy in them, or otherwise the sort of stag, or you find yourself wondering, you know, how much breath am I going to need for this? So I like that movement.
Yeah, yeah. So the breath, in fact, in that respect, you need, I suppose, less breath for a faster phrase. What were you going to say there, Peter?
No, just that the old instruments as well mean that you can play, the orchestra can play full without covering the chorus or the singers. So actually, it's all taken care of already. You don't have to manage the dynamics so as not to cover the singer, for instance. It just seems to happen more organically with the old instruments.
Of course, in this upcoming performance, you have the opposite problem to Fish Amble back in the 1740s when 700 tickets were sold for 600 seats or 600 places. Hence the men leaving their swords outside and the women having to remove the hoops from their skirts, as the story goes. What difference will the social distancing make in terms of the performance, Peter?
Well, yeah, we all have to be, you know, very careful about how we present this. The Messiah is a very it's an important institution, I guess, for Irish people, for the audiences in Dublin. We'd normally perform it in one of the big cathedrals, as you say, with lots of people there. But I just think it's just important to keep the show on the road and keep the kind of a placeholder that at least we're performing it. We, of course, we take all the necessary precautions. Mm. The singers are apart from each other. The instrumentalists are apart. And that causes its own difficulties. You know, we have to get used to that. And but it is possible. And, you know, with everybody, the best will and trying very, very hard. It'll all come together, yeah.
Well, let's listen to let's listen to one of the choruses, actually, from the piece, a very well-known chorus for Unto Us a Child Is Born. You picked a performance by the Dunedin Consort that is particularly suitable, Peter. Why that consort? What about this performance is it that you like?
Well, this particular performance John Butt is conducting it, and he's a great Bach scholar and a Handel scholar, and he did a lot of work into recreating the original 1742 Dublin version for this recording. So there's some movements that hadn't been composed yet that are very famous nowadays, and some arias written for different singers. Handel was very pragmatic. The different places he went, he changes pieces for who is available to him. And so actually having a listen to the original Dublin version is very interesting. He uses some people from the cathedral choirs we thought are very good, and that didn't make it into later versions. But it has a different flow and a different feel, the original one, and it's definitely worth having a listen to for anybody who's unfamiliar with it.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, even the introduction here to For Unto Us a Child Is Born is a much swifter affair than we might normally get. Let's have a listen. Or Unto Us a Child Is Born, of course, from Handel's Messiah, in a performance there by the Dunedin Concert. And the Irish Baroque Orchestra will be performing this piece along with Chamber Choir Ireland on this coming Thursday in the National Concert Hall. And Peter Whelan and Sarah Power, soprano, are speaking with me this evening. Peter Whelan, the director of the Irish Baroque Orchestra, and conducting the performance on this coming Thursday evening. As I'm listening to that, it really strikes me, you know, if you have bigger forces for a chorus like that, and the way that Handel may well have written it, Peter, you really in that performance hear every single syllable, every single word, and keeping a line of singers together when there's a much smaller group, maybe only three or four altos, three or four sopranos singing, that must make Handel's music much clearer in the way he would have intended it.
Yes, absolutely. Actually, just listening to that now, that chorus started life as a duet for two sopranos and bass from his time in Italy, and then he's a very practical composer. You know, he recycled it for use in this piece. And just before that moment, we have all the the bass is talking about darkness and the valley of death. And then suddenly this piece, For Unto Us, and he's obviously thinking sunshine, Italy, and that those bright colours. For him, it doesn't make a huge difference. The text is changed. Actually, it's quite funny listening to the text of Messiah. Handel, obviously, English isn't his first language, so sometimes he sets things in a slightly funny way, the English language, but it's always, like Sarah says, very easy to sing. And you know, it can be light in its feet. And the first Dublin performances, it's likely that there are probably three or four singers on a part. So the initial feel would have been of several soloists on stage rather than a choir, and many of them stepping out one at a time to do the solo. So it would have quite a different feel to the one we're used to today, at least in the first performance.
Yeah, but I guess, Sarah, and you're here as a soloist, obviously, in this case, but Chamber Choir Ireland would have that type of facility for, you know, two or three singers per line. Yes, you're more exposed as a singer, but it's also, things are much clearer for the listener.
Yes, absolutely. Funnily enough, the last Messiah that I sang was last Christmas with the Dunedin Consort and John Butt conducting. And I was singing the soprano solos and I was in the chorus. So I sang everything. Yeah. And it was quite demanding, but it was very special. And as you say, a chamber choir has a special kind of colour and quality, and the words are so much clearer. Well, I mean, the words can be very clear in a large choir as well, but there's something very special about hearing each individual line coming out.
Sure. And so you sang it in that way, where you were part of a line of singers and then you stepped out to do the solo part. So that's quite interesting, given what Peter has just said. Finally then, Peter, I'm wondering if people, which is because people come along to big performances of Messiah and they want to sing along with some of the choruses that they know, I guess they'll be able to do that at home. Will they be able to follow it in their score? Will they find, oh, that's not in my score. Mine's not the original 1742. Are there big differences?
No, there are not huge differences between it. There's just a couple of little recitatives and one chorus that's missing from the original one. But I think people following for this performance won't have too many surprises. You'll get all the big hits if you want to sing along at home. And yeah, they should feel very welcome to. It's a good opportunity to do that.
And should they stand for the Hallelujah chorus or not?
Oh, God, that's controversial. Yeah, I don't know. Never know what to say with that one, yeah.
Yeah, well,
I say stand.
You say stand. Well, it certainly didn't happen in Dublin because the King wasn't present. It was that the King stood at some performance and therefore everybody had to stand, and that's where the tradition started. That's how it goes, I think, isn't it? Nobody's going to agree with me.
Yeah, not sure.
Well, that's the story I was told, so I'm sticking with that one.
Okay.
Right, so stand or not, whatever you want to do for the Hallelujah chorus that we're about to listen to in, again, the Dunedin Consort. But remember, the one that the performances we're speaking about is the Irish Baroque Orchestra, along with Chamber Choir Ireland, and Sarah Power, soprano, will be there as well. I'll give you more details after we listen to the Hallelujah chorus. Hallelujah chorus from Handel's Messiah, and you can hear that the full oratorio with the Chamber Choir Ireland Irish Baroque Orchestra, conducted by Peter Whelan, Sarah Power soprano, who we were speaking to earlier on. The other soloists are Sarah Richmond mezzo soprano, Dean Power tenor, and James Platt bass. Full details of the performance streamed live this Thursday, 8 p.m. December the 3rd, and ticket holders will have access to the performance then for 48 hours following that initial concert stream, so you could listen to it once or twice if you want it subsequent to it. You can find out full details on nch.ie. County Lines, the debut feature from director Henry Blake, is a coming-of-age story about a young mother and of her 14-year-old son who was groomed into involvement in County Lines, the lethal nationwide drug-dealing networks in the UK, which exploit vulnerable children into trafficking drugs. Writer and director Henry Blake based the film on his own experience. He's been a youth worker for 11 years and was first exposed to County Lines back in 2015 in London. His first-hand knowledge has enabled him to create an authentic film that captures the harsh reality so many vulnerable young people are going through right now, all over the UK and probably in this country as well. Henry Blake joins me now. Henry, it's an extraordinary story that we get told through the eyes of this character, Tyler. How closely related to your own story is this tale?
Very closely related, you know, in relation to my experience in 2015, what I was dealing with as a youth worker was everything that's in the film. I mean, there are scenes in the film that are verbatim, you know, from my experience. And I've always said that this film, for me, is very much a diary entry.
Hmm. Explain that term, County Lines.
County Lines is a national drug distribution network or series of networks which traffics vulnerable children and exploits them. And the word line refers to the mobile phone line, which essentially has a mobile phone can have a lot of drug users' contacts in them. And when criminal networks, say, are around in a rural area, they'll use that mobile phone to promote their business to those drug users by sending text messages out. And then the children will then deliver the drugs and traffic them across area boundaries, etc. So the children are at the sort of mechanism, if you like, to promote the business.
And the important thing there, and the frightening aspect, as we see in the film for sure, is this idea that it's a vulnerable child, often young teenagers, some of them. I think, does Tyler tell us at one stage in the film that he's 14, I think, is the age he gives? There are younger children for sure, younger boys in the car at other stages. They're going from one drug baron's turf to another drug baron's turf. That's a dangerous business.
Yeah, it is a very dangerous business, and not all of the risks are laid out in front of children when they are first sort of becoming recruited and exploited. And there's many, many risk factors. So, you know, one has to argue. A lot of the time I met with, you know, well, they know what they signed up for and you know, they did the crime, so they should do the time. But what that is not recognizing is a context which includes the push and pull factors as to why a child might be susceptible and vulnerable to this style of criminality. And also what it doesn't look at is the trauma, is the depth of trauma and exploitation. And consistently over the years, that has been a theme that has grown within communities. And many safeguarding professionals are increasingly shocked and distressed at what they're seeing. And there doesn't seem to be nationally a sort of authored specific response to this, this type of exploitation.
What role do you think poverty plays in all of this?
Huge role. Huge role, Sean. Deprivation and poverty is huge. And I mean, you know, it's the elephant in the room, isn't it? And it's touched on annually and there's a discussion and then, you know, it gets paid a little bit of lip service and then it goes away again. And I think, you know, deprivation is a massive factor in this, which can be a push factor, it can be a pull factor, because what do you do if a child is essentially embarking on a County Lines episode, and that cash is then filtered back into the domestic life of that child.
Let's listen to a clip actually featuring a character called Simon, played by Harris Dickinson, and he's basically the guy who's grooming young Tyler into all of this activity, and to, you know, he knows exactly where poor Tyler's weak points are. He knows Tyler's situation at home, which is very difficult. There's poverty at home. His mother has lost her job. She's having real difficulty, you know, finding anything to support the family. So this is how Harris Dickinson's Simon speaks to Conrad Kahn's Tyler around, you know, this is what this job can do for you. And, you know, think about what you can do at home with all of this. And they speak to each other sometimes quite coarsely.
If you got a job, it's a bit lazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
I used to work for some older guy when I was your age.
Doing what?
Just running errands, things like that.
You pee?
Enough for me to help my mum out. Obviously, she weren't working, so I had to be the man of the house.
I'm the man of my house.
Is it? Yeah. Should get a job then, innit?
Yeah. Stressful, though.
Stressful. That's what being a man's about, though, dealing with stress. Isn't it?
Mm.
And you deal with stress.
Don't know. Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Good.
Typically low-key scene there from County Lines. Harris Dickinson as Simon, the manipulator in that scene, without any doubt, and Conrad Kahn as the young Tyler, whose story very much mirrors, I believe, that of Henry Blake, the writer and director who's speaking to me this evening. It is a very manipulative scene, and it's just the beginning of it. What also really struck me, Henry, was how when young Tyler sees how these men behave around women, he immediately is brutalized by their activities and copycats everything he sees. The violence, the awful treatment, all of it. He's into it in 3 seconds, even though he's a lovely guy at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good observation, Sean, because, you know, we have a saying in sort of youth work, you know, some things cannot be unseen, you know, and what he witnesses is, plays into his trauma. And often with County Lines cases, you know, that trauma spills out into the home life of the family. And what is not spoken a lot about, although I know from firsthand goes on a lot, is child-on-parent violence, where the child then transforms before the parent's eyes and they feel scared. And it's all at that funny stage anyway, removing all of this exploitation, where a 14-year-old child sort of is transitioning, especially a boy, from a boy to a man. So there's all these factors that play in, and then the parent often is having to deal with, you know, a shell of what they once knew. And that's very, very difficult, and parents feel very voiceless in all of this.
To what extent, Henry, are you hoping that the film, in fact, will start and propel a debate around this type of activity?
I mean, I think there's a lot of debate already going on, and there's a lot of many, many safeguarding professionals and charities, etc., and local authorities doing some wonderful work. You know, I know many of them. What I hope is I want it to get under people's skin, so, you know, County Lines just doesn't remain a headline for people or a concept, but actually an emotional and psychological reality. And if it makes you feel uncomfortable, then good, because it's an uncomfortable topic, and we cannot continually just
ignore that.
Bring neglect on. Yeah, exactly.
Well, it did make me feel uncomfortable, but in a way that made me think a lot too. Very upsetting film, but very powerful film. And thanks for giving it to us. That's Henry Blake, writer and director of County Lines. And County Lines will be released in the IFI in Dublin this Friday, December the 4th. It will be also available across digital platforms. That is our lot for this Monday evening. Anne-Marie Donnellan was the broadcast coordinator. Leah Murphy was the researcher. Dave Gibson was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead.